when you laugh? What does it mean? Why do you laugh? Well, there's all kinds of different ways that people laugh, aren't they? People laugh in that slightly awkward way because you've dropped a hammer on your foot and they don't know what to say. They laugh with joy and delight. Something good has come. Laugh in that unkind, a mocking way. When we laugh at rather than with people. We can laugh in that dismissive, cynical way. Don't believe it. Well, in our passage today, and at earlier points in the chapters we've been looking at, we come across laughter. And so that's where we'll end up. But I want to almost approach the passage backwards. I want to work backwards through the passage. I want you to see how the passage fulfills promises that God has been given to Abraham. The promise that there would be land for Abram's descendants. The promise that from this one man, and the Bible tells us he is good as dead, from this one man would come offspring, we're told, as numerous as the sands on the shore, and nations would come from him. Whole countries, groups of people would be descended from him. We'll see that promise fulfilled. And there was a promise that God would bless him and make him a byword for blessing and make him into a blessing to all the world. And so the promises of land and of descendants and of blessing unfold in this chapter. And as I say, we're going to work through it almost kind of backwards. And the first thing then we're going to see is Abimelech, the promise of land. Tail end of the chapter, beginning in verse 22, Abimelech and the commander of his army come to Abraham. Now, and you've been following as we've gone along. We didn't turn up this week out of the blue, but rather chapter 21 follows chapter 20. Not saying anything too radical there, I don't think. And this same character, Abimelech, appears in both. And so Abimelech bookends the narrative for us. In the first narrative, in chapter 20, you remember what happened. Abraham went down, moved down to where Abimelech was king, said that his wife Sarah was his sister. Abimelech took a bit of a shine to her, takes her off to be his wife. And then God acts by sending disease, some sort of plague on Abimelech and his household. And then God comes and speaks to Abimelech in a dream. When God speaks to you and tells you you're a dead man, you pay attention. And Abimelech really did. We saw how at times even our sin can be unintentional and yet brings us under condemnation, how God provides a way to deal with that, that there is a God in his kindness and mercy deals with the sins we don't even realize we've committed because he's a gracious God. But at the end of the chapter, a shame-faced Abraham, he has to be confronted and rebuked by Abimelech. And when Abraham is basically saying that I reckon these are godless people, there's no fear of God in them at all. Actually, it's Abraham who was acting in the godless way. And it is Abimelech who was the one who seemed to honor and to fear God in that. So in the first, in chapter 20, that first part of this narrative, the first bookend, if you like, it's Abimelech who has to rebuke Abraham. But by the end of the chapter, the end of chapter 21, when Abimelech comes, see what he says. God is with you in everything you do. And the king has to recognize, has been forced to recognize that God is with him. That idea of God being with someone will come up again as we go through Genesis. You'll see it about Jacob, for instance, as he deals with his uncle, Laban. You'll see it particularly about Joseph. Repeatedly, we'll be told that God is with him in what he does. And so the king, recognizing that God is at work in Abraham, God is with you in everything you do, the king comes and he wants to make a treaty. It ought to be something about God at work in his people that gives them a certain credibility, that is attractive to other people. It's not that they always see eye to eye with you. It's not that they always agree with you. It's not even always that they like you. But there is something about those who God is with that has a credibility. Someone described it in this way to me. They were speaking about their church, and their church was doing a lot of work with against poverty in their community. And someone said to them, "We do not agree with you. We don't believe what you believe, but we are glad you are here." That's a wonderful evidence of God being at work in a people. God is with you in everything you do. And so the king comes and he wants to make a treaty. He wants to make an alliance. There's been this dispute rumbling on about wells and so on. And they settle it. It's solved. And Abraham gets to dwell peacefully in the land. God has promised the land to him. And now another barrier, another conflict has been smoothed out of the way, because God keeps his promises. Abraham, we are told, stayed in the land of the Philistines. Well, there's Abimelech and the promise of land. And working backwards, the second thing I want us to see is Ishmael and the promise of nations. The promise of a multiplying of descendants. And although I've used the word Ishmael in giving you that kind of heading, you, if you were observant, would have noticed that Ishmael's name was striking by its absence as we read it. Let me read it to you. Verse 9. Sarah saw that the son whom Hagar the Egyptian had borne to Abram was mocking. She said to Abram, "Get rid of the slave woman and her son, for that slave woman's son will never share in the inheritance with my son." The matter distressed Abram because it concerned his son. But God said to him, "Do not be so distressed about the boy and your maidservant." On to verse 13. "I will make the son of the maidservant into a nation." He sent them on her, verse 14, Abraham set them on her shoulders and sent her off with the boy. Verse 15, she put the boy. Verse 16, "I cannot watch the boy die." God, verse 17, heard the boy. Do you see? He's entirely anonymous. He never gets mentioned by name. Isn't that interesting? By contrast, Isaac's name comes up repeatedly. 6 times in the short appearance that Isaac makes, his name is mentioned, but the slave woman's son, the boy, Ishmael's his name, never gets mentioned. There's a conflict brewing now. What is going to happen between Ishmael and Isaac, between the two sons of Abraham? Who's going to inherit the blessing? What would happen if Abraham died now? We discover there's a feast on the day when Isaac is weaned. So in this culture, weaning takes place at about 3 years of age. We know that Ishmael was born sometime before. Ishmael is probably about 17 years old now. So these two competing lines, you can see the possibility of tension between them. You can see Sarah's concern for her son. And then we are told she sees Ishmael mocking. In verse 9, her son Isaac. The word mocking is the same word that gives us the word laughter elsewhere in the passage. Same Hebrew word. to mock, to laugh. But it's also a word that sometimes gets used with really negative connotations. What's this 17-year-old boy doing against this child? How inappropriate this mocking, this is. And Sarah sees him doing this. And frankly, she's... Well, you can hear her anger. You can sense her fear. Paul, when he writes about this, he comments on it in Galatians chapter 4. He says that Ishmael was persecuting Isaac. Ishmael is the firstborn, the older son. There's a theme that runs through the Bible of God overlooking the firstborn. The blessings, the things that ought to go to the firstborn in this culture, that would be the great weight, would end up with him. There's this kind of running theme of them being overlooked almost, or passed over for the sake of the secondborn and for a younger. The very first boys born, Cain and Abel. It's Abel that receives God's favour and Cain that doesn't. In among Noah's sons, the oldest son is Japheth, but it's Shem that gets God's blessing. Abraham actually has an older brother, Haran, but it's Abraham that God deals with. You've got Isaac and Ishmael here. You'll have Jacob and Esau later on. You'll have Reuben is the oldest of Jacob's sons, but it's Judah that gets the promised blessing. Of Judah's sons, it's the younger one, not the older, that gets the blessing. It's Moses that God chooses to use to rescue his people, not Aaron, his older brother. It is David that God sees as being his anointed king, not Eliab, his much older brother. God does what he wants. He is not bound by your expectation of how we ought to work. He doesn't work with us according to our power or our status or our pride or our reputation or our ability to justify ourselves or our claims of status. God, as one of the confessions says, works when and where and how he pleases. He doesn't look at you as the rest of the world does. I don't know what you think of your reputation to the rest of the world. I don't know how exalted you are, how much status you've got. I happen to be a firstborn. God doesn't look on you like everybody else does. God chooses to deal with you in love, despite all the things that you and I know to be true of ourselves. But we have a problem with this potential clash. It's the mess that has come about as the consequence of Abraham and Sarah's sin back in chapter 16 when he took Hagar to get her pregnant. But now Sarah wants Abraham to take action, to get rid of the slave woman, to get rid of her son. And Abraham is grieved over this because Ishmael is his boy. And God comes alongside and reassures Abraham that he's going to take care of Ishmael, that he will fulfill his promise that Ishmael will become a great nation. God said to him, I will make the son of the maidservant into a nation. Why? Because he's your offspring, because I've promised it to you. And you see how even when it seems as though Ishmael is going to die in the desert, God directly intervenes. Why? Because I will make him into a great nation. So there's the promise of land, Abimelech. There's Ishmael, the promise of nations. But now we want to come to Isaac, the promise of blessing. Sarah, presumably all her life, had longed for, ached for this child. Imagine the tears that she'd shed, prayers she'd sent up. The grief in her heart over a lifetime, the agony when any of the women in their little tribe had a baby. How she loved to see the baby and yet chokes back tears at the same time. She had given up on hoping. God comes and speaks to Abraham in chapter 17 and says, you're going to have a child by Sarah. And Abraham, we're told, bows his face to the ground. Why? To cover the fact he's laughing. Can't believe it. Yeah, right. Pull the other one, it's got bells on it. And then we come to chapter 18. And the encounter with God meets with Abraham at the tent. And he says, I'm going to come back in a year and your wife Sarah is going to have a son. I remember what she did. She laughed and God rebukes her. Why did you laugh? I didn't laugh. Oh, you did laugh. She laughed. She scoffed at God's promise. It's that ha laughing, as if. But now look at the text. It is open in front of you, isn't it? Look at it. The Lord was gracious to Sarah, as he'd said. And the Lord did for Sarah what he had promised. She became pregnant and bore a son at the very time God had promised. Do you see that? God was gracious. God did what he promised. It was at the very time that God had promised. God did this. The author insists that you see this. And in fact, Sarah sees that herself. Verse 6, God has brought me laughter. God has done this. Who would have said to Abram that Sarah would nurse? It was impossible, she says. Who would have thought? God has done this. And Abraham does, we're told, as God commanded. He names, God had said that the son was to be Isaac. Laughter. That's back in chapter 17. Abraham obeys. And then God, Abraham followed God's command and circumcised him as well. In this wonderful supernatural birth, we must see echoes. Abraham was promised that in him all the nations of the earth would be blessed. But the birth of Isaac foreshadows the miraculous birth of Jesus. It is through God at work, God's grace, God being with Mary, that she became pregnant. This was to happen, to fulfill what was promised, we are told, through the prophets. Paul, writing in Galatians again, tells us that at exactly the right time, that God did this. How could this be, says Mary? I'm a virgin. How could this happen? How could this be, says Sarah? I'm barren and 90. God did this. We're told in the New Testament that Joseph called the baby Jesus as God had told him to. And even that Jesus was circumcised. So there is a kind of foreshadowing of the miraculous birth of Jesus in the supernatural birth of Isaac. But now we get this laughter. Sarah says, God has brought me laughter. And everyone who hears about it will laugh with me. The scoffing of cynicism and unbelief has been replaced by joy. By the infectious laughter of delight. Everyone who hears about it giggles. Here's this 90-year-old lady. She ought to be holding great-great-grandchildren. But instead, she's cradling her firstborn. It's a ridiculous picture. Giggle at it. See the laughter that comes out of it. And this is good news. This is the gospel, isn't it? That for those who weep, and for those who have that kind of cynical laughter, that scoffing, when they come to believe in God's promises, when they see them unfold by faith, when they take God at his word, when they find that Jesus by his death has ransomed and rescued them and set them free, their tears and their cynicism and their ha get replaced by joy. And hard, bitter hearts get softened and warmed by the Holy Spirit at work inside them. And tears. The Bible promises that there is a day coming when Christ will return and every tear will get wiped away forever by him. And so Christian people ought to be people of real joy. of laughter, of delight. Not happiness because your circumstances are always wonderful, because they ain't. But a deep, abiding, resting in God and joy. So Paul, as he writes from prison to the Philippians, he exhorts them repeatedly to rejoice. But their joy is not grounded in their circumstances, but in the reality of their relationship with Jesus Christ. And the place of where God's people gather together ought to be the place where cynicism melts away. It ought to be the place where we hear the sound of laughter with joy. How wonderful, how precious the hope we have is in Jesus Christ, who is the blessing of the whole world, the fulfillment of the promise to Abraham. That's what, let me encourage you, because some of you are believers and you've wept tears over your children for years. And it seems impossible to you that, as it seemed impossible to Sarah that her child could ever come to birth, it seems impossible to you that your children could ever come to a spiritual birth, to new life. Yet pray on. Cling on in hope. Don't be dispirited. Don't be cynical. And some of you wept tears over your husband or your wife. And it seems impossible to you that they could ever be softened. And yet see the supernatural work that God does, visiting Sarah and transforming her. And you've wept over your church and over the community and over the nation in which God has put us. And at the thought of things being better or different, you almost are tempted to scoff. And to you, loved ones, I've got to tell you that God is able to turn your ha into ha ha. Into the laughter of joy. How? Because of faith in Jesus Christ. Because of coming to him and believing in his promises. So let me invite you, if you laugh in a ha way, if you're bitter and cynical and you've just been disappointed too many times by too many things, let me invite you to come to Jesus. Here he is. He is trustworthy. He is God himself. And he won't and he can't disappoint you. And you can come to him and you can know joy. And you can know delight. And you can know wholeness and healing of heart. And you can say with Sarah that everyone who hears about this will laugh. Well, we're going to sing. You might think it a slightly unseasonal choice. I hope you will understand why we're singing it. Interestingly, it's a hymn that although we often sing it at Christmas, it's not actually a Christmas carol. It's not particularly about Jesus' first coming, but it looks forward to his second coming. When tears get wiped away. When thorns and thistles don't grow anymore. And when we know this perfect delight and joy, yes, and even laughter. Let's stand and sing together, Joy to the World.